Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. David Adler will discuss the Greek elections, which saw Syriza and its leader Alexis Tsipras voted out of power. And then Joel Whitney will discuss the CIA's pursuit of the Chilean poet Pablo Neruda in the late 1940s and early 1950s. First, Greece. On July 7th, Greece held parliamentary elections. Syriza, the left-wing party led by Alexis Tsipras, which had been in power since 2015, was turned out of office, succeeded by the right-wing New Democracy Party, led by Kyriakos Mitsotakis. Syriza came into office promising resistance to austerity imposed by the EU and the European Central Bank. Soon after taking office, Tsipras put the Eurocrats' austerity program up for a national referendum. Even though 61% voted to reject it, Tsipras accepted it anyway, and Greece continues to suffer from what former finance minister and frequent Behind the News guest Yanis Varoufakis called fiscal waterboarding. The Syriza government survived for another 4 years, and now it's out. Why? Here's David Adler, policy director of the Democracy in Europe Movement 2025, known as DiEM25, the movement to democratize the EU founded by Varoufakis after he left government. You can find a piece Adler wrote on the topic on The Guardian's website. David Adler. Tsipras and Syriza are out. Who are their successors?
New Democracy has swept to office in something close to a landslide. So Syriza's vote share actually decreased not as much as we were expecting. I think the margin was 38 point something for New Democracy to 31 point something for Syriza. But this new party, which is being portrayed as a very modern party, as a very anti-populist party, actually has pretty deep roots both in the Greek oligarchy as well as in more nasty or factions of the right-side populist Greek political scene as well. So the new prime minister, Mitsotakis, whose father was the prime minister, although that doesn't seem to deter anyone from portraying him as an up-and-coming modernizer, has brought together a coalition of far-right to center-right politicians under this banner of, you know, tax cuts, deregulation, and of course, enhanced austerity at the whim of his European comrades in the European People's Party, of which Merkel is a member. They, you know, swept to power on the basis of this anti-populist message of we're going to take the country back, unleash the private sector, and finally get Greece back on its feet.
And they're very explicit about this. This is not a hidden agenda. It's an explicit agenda.
It's a very explicit agenda. What's been less explicit and far less present in some of the more glowing profiles you'll see of Mitsotakis is that New Democracy has historically been home to many strains of Greek fascist politics. This is a party that has its roots in a post-junta, post-dictatorship Greece, when it was gathering a lot of the sort of ruling class in Greece to support its big business oligarchs, its ship owners, etc. So many of those strains still remain. Some of the ministers who are being highly promoted in Mitsotakis' cabinet are you know, virulent anti-Semites, have spoken out doing sort of revisions of Greek history to say, well, actually no one died in the uprisings against the Greek dictatorship and the junta. So a lot of that is being collected in New Democracy. And that's kind of double-edged sword of the disappearance of Golden Dawn, the more famous neo-fascist party who has since been designated as a terrorist organization for their role in various assassinations, which is that they failed to hit the threshold, but in part they failed to hit the threshold because of slightly more civilized elements of their coalition have been absorbed into New Democracy. So we're seeing some of that come together, but definitely there's an intense dissonance between the portrait in the pages of the international press that call them modernizers and I mean, we're talking about really an old guard in Greece, religious, nationalist, far from the anti-populist portraits we're seeing emerging in the post-election period.
Greeks voted for this despite all those years of austerity, all the misery that Greece was put through. They're voting for austerity and neoliberalism all over again.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's important to preface this conversation by saying, okay, it hasn't been that big of a swing. I mean, just like when we talk about American politics, it's not like this mythical Obama to Trump voter. That's really not where the conversation is at. It's much more about how did Syriza fail to keep it's energy on the left in Greece. Why did so many of those people disappear? Why did so many young people, for example, 30% of 17 to 30, 24-year-olds voted for New Democracy? Why did their radicalism disappear? And how was New Democracy able to kind of cohere that right-wing faction? It's stunning nonetheless, given the, like you said, 10-plus years of fiscal waterboarding undergone by this country. But I think a lot of the blame lies with Syriza itself for laying the groundwork for that neoliberal transition.
And is there any kind of nationalist, you know, anti-EU sentiment that's prominent at all in Greek politics?
Well, so we've got to separate those two bits that you just mentioned, the nationalist and the anti-EU. These are things we've long thought went together in the European context, right? That Euroscepticism was associated with nationalism. And I think that's changing a lot, especially as we see a more resurgent far right that's much more confident about its ability or its prospects for capturing power in the EU institutions, and who don't have to resort so much to the exit button or to Euroscepticism to convey their nationalist message. I think New Democracy is a pioneer of sorts in that regard. So, you know, you'll remember that there was a big controversy because Tsipras, in one of his more progressive moves in his late prime ministerial period, put forward a deal with Macedonia for their name change, a very big controversy over Macedonia, which occupies this highly mythical, important status in Greek history, and which riles up a lot of more nationalist Greeks to say, no, these Macedonians can't even have that word. Tsipras, in pursuit of the Nobel Peace Prize, sought to broker a deal with the Macedonian government in that regard. Now, that stirred up an intense amount of xenophobia and nationalism on the Greek right. Now, where was Mitsotakis, now current prime minister and great friend of the modernizing Harvard McKinsey elite? Well, he was against that name deal and standing on the streets of Greece as the nationalists sort of burned down cities and, in fact, led to, I think, a couple of deaths at the hands of some of these more nationalist figures. So they're kind of innovative, where they're promoting a nationalist sentiment, but it's not embedded in a broader Euroscepticism. It's actually kind of, it can go along with more pro-European, or at least right-side pro-European stance.
Macedonia, that's not a very large target, whereas Brussels or Frankfurt would be a very large target. So this nationalism is directed against a rather weak opponent rather than strong opponents.
You know, it's not so different than what we're seeing in other parts of Europe. Take Salvini, right? The chief pioneer in this far right transition. A lot of the early rhetoric, just even a year and a half ago, would have been Salvini railing against Brussels and also arguing for euro exit. You know, they promised to put eurozone membership to a referendum in last year's elections. The Five Star and the League both supported that. What's happened in the years since is, I guess, largely because Brexit has revealed itself to be extremely complex and highly costly, a lot of those far-right parties, or in the case of Mitsotakis, center-right and fascist-friendly, have given up on the prospects of exit, and they've turned their targets really away from Brussels towards much weaker elements of their society. So in Salvini's case, he targets migrants. Mitsotakis has also called for the deportation of more migrants, although at least he does that on the basis of a human rights basis. So he says, Tsipras has betrayed his promise to clean up migrant camps in Greece. True. He has let them become warehouses of souls. True. He's let them become places where sexual violence, severe overcrowding, and the lack of resources is a severe problem. Also true. But Mitsotakis uses that as an opportunity to say, and therefore we should deport more migrants, not to say, and therefore we should do a better job at providing and integrating them. I think there's been a general turn away from the big bogeyman of Brussels toward a focus on things that are much, much closer at hand in terms of political opponents that can be the stuff of a right-wing populism.
To Syriza, where did they go wrong? I mean, as you say in your Guardian piece, you know, there's a left-wing critique, which is that the failure to exit the euro, the failure to break with the EU. Right-wing critique, it was a collision with reality, and all these socialist dreams were smashed on the rocks of capitalist reality. What's your analysis? Where did Syriza go wrong?
You've got to look at that crucial moment in July 2015 when you have a referendum, this magnificent moment in Greek history, this great Ohi vote, where 61% of Greeks voted against austerity. It's crucial that we be a bit generous about that moment, which was full of uncertainty and was definitely a fraught moment for the Syriza government, insofar as they were caught between a rock and a hard place, the rock being this Ohi vote, this amazing resistance movement by the massive swathe of Greek society, as well as, you know, roughly 80% of Greeks who didn't want to exit, who didn't want to face the consequences from a abrupt, rough rupture with the European Union. So we can be sympathetic to that moment. But what happened then basically is a lot of the social movement energy that was really bound up with Syriza's rapid rise to power in the years that preceded their election in January 2015, exited from the party. So that ranges from people who are in the ministries, like Yanis Varoufakis, to left movements that basically, you know, were in favor of Grexit themselves. And what's important about that moment is not just the capitulation itself. I mean, we can go all day about what the exact play-by-play was of Tsipras' decision to capitulate to the Troika. It's much more that a spirit of rebellion was lost in that moment. And it was precisely at that moment that Syriza became little more than a kind of electoralist machine, much more focused on maintaining power, doing the little it could to nudge Greece in a more progressive direction while basically conceding the whole radical left agenda that brought it to power. Then what you see is a much more narrow focus on dividing the spoils of office. You see a much narrower focus on Tsipras as a man. It's very common to hear people say, oh, Tsipras is Syriza. So depending on the whims of this particular political personality, making their politics very fragile and very vulnerable to whatever decisions he chooses to make. So you really see the party disconnect from its base. And the solidarity movements that power that here, you know, in the grassroots, on the ground in cities like Athens, begin to shrivel up. Without the kind of close links, without that spirit of rebellion, the sense of ennui in terms of the imposition of austerity, that all culminated last summer in August 2018, when there was this insane circus celebration hosted by Tsipras and his party of, oh, we're unleashed from our debt bondage. Finally, we're out from the bailout program, when actually he'd signed the country up to be paying debt back for another 50 years. So that dissonance between the radical left populist rhetoric and the policy program, which was just implementing brutal austerity measures, so brutal, as I mentioned in that Guardian piece, that Wolfgang Schäuble himself, the finance minister of Germany, accused him of putting the burden on the weak because he refused to tax the ship-owning oligarchs. Everything just kind of went it's up from there. But I think we've got to start from a sense of what happens when a radical left party evacuates itself from the social movement that led it to power in the first place.
What lesson do we draw from this, that power corrupts and that any left-wing government taking power is going to fall into this kind of trap? Or is there a way out?
It's tough. I mean, some of the feedback I've gotten on the piece, even in the past couple of days, has been that I'm not particularly generous to Tsipras, given the context of the Greek situation, where they were sort of caught, as I mentioned, between the rock and the hard place. And I think that there's an element of truth to that. We can sympathize with the hard, difficult decisions that come along with high office. I also think none of this, neither the rock nor its hard place, explains the turn that Tsipras has made, whether that's in terms of migration, where he swung from a much more sympathetic position to basically delivering the EU-Turkey deal that forced migrants out of the country and over to Turkey. It's a very, very dirty backhand deal they made with Erdogan, the EU. Whether that's in buddying up to Netanyahu and his oil-owning mates, whether that's selling arms to Mohammed bin Salman, or whether that's buying fighter jets from Donald Trump. Nothing can really explain that.
What does explain those things? So, like, why buddying up to Netanyahu? Why sell arms to MBS? Like, what's going on there?
The major lesson to take from this is that you can't have it all, right? You can't be a left-wing hero at home and ingratiate yourself to an international establishment abroad. You can't be a left-wing firebrand who's talking about supporting the poor while enabling oligarchs at the same time. That you can't talk about battling against Brussels while secretly on the phone to Merkel, reassuring her that you're going to accept whatever austerity positions are forced on you. One of the crucial things to take away for left-wing parties in general is that pandering doesn't work. When you go back to May, ahead of the European elections, before we had these snap national elections last week, Syriza decided, you know what, in order to stanch the bleeding towards the right side, we're going to issue this package of stimulus that is basically pension bonuses and tax cuts, essentially cribbing the New Democracy economic program. And a lot of their voters looked at the party and said, you know, why would we take this ersatz pro-business, pro-oligarchy Syriza when we could just have the real thing in the form of Mitsotakis? If we're going to do this neoliberalism thing, let's do it without you winking toward a pro-poor, anti-austerian program that doesn't exist. The good news is that being principled or being unprincipled is not a winning position. I mean, it would be hard if it were the other way around, but that being principled actually is the only way to keep, especially a radical left politics, alive.
I'm speaking with David Adler, policy director of DiEM25. Tsipras' defenders would say that taxing the oligarchs wouldn't be possible. They would take all their capital and perhaps themselves out of the country, and so he had no choice. What do you say to that?
I think that that is a totally fair critique. And we have to understand any of these countries, whether it's, frankly, whether it's Corbyn's Britain or whether it's Tsipras's Greece, in the context of a global capitalism that puts severe, you know, very harsh pressures on especially small countries to accommodate the whims of international investors. I think we'd be very sympathetic for that. But Tsipras never bothered to lead any kind of international movement, neither to democratize the European Union, neither to change some of these rules, neither targeting WTO. I mean, we're talking about a missed opportunity that reverberates across Europe and around the world. So, you know, the counterfactual there is not just, okay, did he tax the oligarchs, but it was, okay, did he try to lead an international movement from this moment, this tremendous amount of political capital he had to spend as a symbol of hope for anti-austerian movements in Europe and also radical left movements around the world? Did he try to use that, leverage that moment to spark a broader conversation around those constraints? No, he didn't. So I think we can both be sympathetic to the structural constraints as well as critical of the agentic sort of opportunities that were available to him that were not, what were roads not taken.
And then, of course, the social democratic parties in Germany and elsewhere in core Europe didn't do much to help either.
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, as you mentioned in the introduction, I work with the Democracy in Europe movement, whose whole premise is that what happened in Greece happened in large part because of this vacuum of solidarity in the rest of the continent, that it's only by those social movements working together that any of these small countries can achieve those substantive changes. It goes back to your point about the ship-owning oligarchs. I think just to return to that question for a second, it's not just that he didn't tax the oligarchs. It's also that he ushered in this new generation of oligarchs on the back of these massive state privatization programs, which, again, he did nothing to challenge. If you get down into the details, it's not that he didn't beat neoliberal globalization. It's not that he didn't beat capitalism. It's that Syriza was elected to try to fight creatively and courageously and in a principled way, to look for small ways of keeping that flame of rebellion alive, as a way not only to solve Greek problems, but to be a source of inspiration for people around the world. And that is the missed opportunity. And that's the thing that we should grieve for most. And that is the hope that, you know, with Syriza out of office, we can begin to recuperate that sense of rebellion, recuperate that sense of hope in a left politics that is confrontational, which is something that Tsipras just refused to do.
When I interviewed Yanis Varoufakis a couple of years ago, he told me that he just couldn't for the life of him figure out what was going through Tsipras's head, why he betrayed the referendum vote, the no vote, and made the austerity deal. Has the passage of time made that any clearer, what was going on in his head?
I'll leave Yanis to follow up on whether he thinks that what exactly was going on in Alexis's head around the time of the capitulation. It is still important that we keep in mind that was Grexit a credible threat? I think people make very different evaluations of whether a forced Grexit, which was Schäuble's ideal scenario, you'll recall that that many parts of the German establishment, especially the German right-wing establishment, were in favor of kicking Greece out of the Eurozone and indeed of the European Union. So I think it was just basic fear. But now with the passage of time, we can see that there was a deeper seed there, that Tsipras was much more keen on the politesse and being close to the establishment than he was in being a proper left-wing rebel. That shows in the complete absence of a confrontational stance in the years that followed. You know, we see at Tsipras in 2015 and we see at Tsipras in 2019. We see one version in 2015 and indeed a different version later that year. So the ability for him to swing like that is, speaks a lot to it. There's a really kind of tragic irony in this, which is that it's long been said that Tsipras is is this amazing political creature, that he's the only one with the wiles to hold together these disparate factions of the Greek left, and indeed that he's uniquely deserving of our support because he is such an impressive political animal. But at the same time, it's likely that that same set of personality traits that made him most vulnerable to capitulation and to giving over some of the more radical principles in favor of, you know, being buddy-buddy with some of these more establishment figures. So again, not sure what the lesson is there, except for looking for more, incorruptible figures and maybe being more suspicious about career politicians who didn't, as Tsipras did, rise up through the baby ranks of the Youth Communist League and, you know, install themselves at every single level of politics with an eye towards the throne. Always.
So what's the mix here of personality and structural pressures?
Oh, Doug, that's an impossible question. I think I'll leave that one for the historians. I also think we're a bit too close to it to get a sense. What I'll say is it's hard not to get the sense that a lot of it has to do with personality. When the laundry list of, frankly, far-right policy that Tsipras was very happy to oversee, did he have to buy fighter jets from Donald Trump? I mean, yes, okay, to form a government, Tsipras brought on the ANEL, this Nationalist Greek Party, which is, you know, part of just the kind of dirty of electoral politics. Not great, but you might be able to forgive him for that kind of thing. But if you look at any kind of the staples of progressive policy here, I mean, the people I work with on the ground, I work with a lot of in migration, so a lot of asylum lawyers and people who and touch a lot of migrants, the inability to kind of or the unwillingness to step up and, for example, curb horrendous police violence against migrants. We've got to think that this is within the capacity, at least on a domestic level, that it's not to do with austerity. That's to do with just political courage to try to take on some of those same factions.
Okay, now the big question about the EU. A lot of people say that the big mistake was, you know, not doing Grexit. And so the conclusion we should draw from this whole episode is that the EU is hopeless, unreformable, and is the enemy of all properly thinking people on the left. What about that?
So I think the headline here is that it's really, really difficult and very unwise to extrapolate from the Greek case. There are important lessons that you can draw and important lessons you can't draw. So to take one clear case of the former, or the latter, I should say, is when you have these Lexiteers in Britain who are talking about the need to exit from the European Union as a way of extracting themselves from this monstrous neoliberal machine and expressing their solidarity with indebted member states when, you know, Britain isn't even in the euro, it's not caught in that architecture, and also has, if anything, an historic obligation to help lead the process for reform. So I'm not sure we can draw the highest level lessons from the experience of Greece, because it was very particular and because they were intent on making an example out of it. When it comes to the role of the European Union, there can be no doubt this was financial terrorism of the highest order. It was blackmail. It was kind of the worst kind of crimes that you can imagine under the guise of a more civilized institution like the European Union. To me, that doesn't really speak to the actual empirical case of Greece as it unfolded between 2010 and 2015. It doesn't speak to me to a counterfactual of what it actually is possible or could be possible with a different political opportunity structure. What the Greek case does is reveal to us some of these more authoritarian tendencies and authoritarian capacities that are built into the European institutions as they're constructed now. But they also reveal to us a huge failure of the left as well. Many people look to the European Union and think, oh my God, what is this hyper-globalizing neoliberal machine? And then you realize, okay, well, actually most of the power in the European Union is invested in its nation states. And most of those nation states are run by right-wing governments. The left is losing at every level. Looking to place unique blame at the European Union level fails to understand how the struggles much lower down have important reverberations upward. Extrapolating from the Greek case is a very convenient way of removing the necessary blame from other left social movements or other countries around Europe that really failed to stand up for Greece in its moment of need because they were terrified of their own fate at the hands of the Eurogroup and the ECB. I will not deny the structural violence of those institutions, but that should be, I think, in our estimation, a spark for a renewed rebellion, a renewed effort to build transnational solidarity and take over those institutions in the way that the far right has been pretty exceptionally agile in mounting that movement to capture and shift the agenda. And that was a bit of a long-winded answer to say, I don't think it has to be either the EU is not guilty and you know, blaming the Greeks, or it has to be that Grexit is the only solution. It has to be both. This was a tragedy of the highest order and needs to be a source of inspiration for reclaiming the European Union and democratizing it in the process.
So you don't believe that DiEM25 is pursuing an illusion because the EU is fundamentally unreformable and must be junked?
Here's what I would say about that. I wake up most days of the week thinking, Jesus Christ, this European Union is a disgusting institution and things it does, like, for example, this Franco-German stitch-up last week where they basically dodged any hint of democratic legitimacy in order to install the mates of Merkel and Macron in the EU top jobs. I think, okay, this is a corrupt and oligarchic institution. Of course, then I remember the United States is no different and that we still wake up in the morning every day and fight to democratize our government in the United States, fight to bring those institutions closer to citizens and fight to make them less corrupt and more responsive to the needs of regular people. Do I think there's something uniquely challenging about the architecture of the European Union? I think that there is something different about those structures and how they get away with being more anti-democratic. But my understanding of the Lexit position is very simple, is to say, you can hate the European Union all you want, but actually, if you look around Europe, there is no democratic mandate for exit right now. In part because of what we talked about before, because Britain has revealed that exit is extremely costly and difficult, but also just because of there's a lot of love for European integration. You may call it false consciousness, but people are, they're into the European Union, draping themselves in EU flags all over the place. Just in the last 3 years alone, positive sentiment to the EU has swung by 9% across the European Union, in some countries upwards of 15. So what does that mean for the case of Lexit? Well, I think from DiEM's position, it means something very simple, which is that, okay, you even to get your precious Lexit, the best thing for us to do is to build a social movement, a transnational movement all across Europe that can stand together and demand the necessary reforms that will tame that European Union, transform a European Union, democratize it, make it responsive to real needs and social movements on the ground. And if at the end of the day, we try that, we build that transnational movement, we stand together, we demand those changes, and they still won't listen, then yeah, let's abandon ship. I mean, you'll notice that DiEM25 has a clock built into it, you know, it has 2025. And that was to send a simple message. We are not absolutist in terms of what the European Union is and should be. We are optimistic in terms of what we feel like we can build, and we're pessimistic in terms of our intellectual assessment of whether we can build it in the very short term. But we've got to try, and nothing is a quicker route from where we are today to actually exiting the European Union, whether that's in Greece or in any other country, than actually raising citizen consciousness about the constraints of the European Union and the inability for those institutions to be responsive to the dreams, desires, and needs of citizens on the ground.
That was David Adler, Policy Director of DiEM25, the Democracy in Europe Movement 2025. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henward, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of Enchima by the Greek composer Ioannis Xenakis, composed in 1975 and performed by the ensemble Jeune Soliste under Rashid Safir. Next, politics and poetry. The great Chilean poet and communist Pablo Neruda was the object of what might have been the first global manhunt of the Cold War. He'd fallen afoul of the Truman administration's orders that Chile curb its left and went on the lam. Joel Ritney wrote about that chase on the occasion of the publication of the first English translation of Neruda's collection Grapes in the Wind, 65 years after it appeared in Spanish, by the small Brooklyn-based press Spite and Dival. Joel Ritney has been on the show a couple of times before to discuss the Cultural Cold War. It's a story he addresses in his book Finks, published by Aura Books. Joel Ritney. Let's talk first about Neruda's background. He didn't start out as quite the communist he became, right?
He was born in the south of Chile, which is pretty poor, and his dad was working class in such a way that Neruda was very much discouraged from letters. And he had some family members who had leftist tendencies, and Neruda seems to have had them from a young age. But these were kind of overshadowed by his love of poetry and sort of passionate poetry at that, love poetry. So he started off his youthful career as a writer, basically as a love poet. He had a book out before he was 20. He followed that up with another one that made him famous, and the predominant note was sort of this melancholy love.
What formed him? Chilean poetry? Spanish poetry? What were his influences?
He would have been influenced by all of the above, including a little bit later this Nicaraguan poet named Rubén Darío, as he was getting more modernist after the Love Poems, his third book, Residence on Earth, he started to get into surrealism. So I think he was reading everything he could get his hands on once he got to Santiago to go to school. He was just like a sponge. So he was reading a lot. There were some political threads passing through his network. But ultimately, he ended up getting into what was kind of a dream job for a writer, into the cultural embassy work that he did in early to mid-career. So he got a post first in Asia, where he did the most isolated, melancholy, surrealist poems from the sections that became Residence on Earth. But then he ended up in Argentina, where he met some leftist poets like Federico Garcia Lorca, who were a little bit engaged. That engaged him somewhat. That propelled him to Spain, where he met his second wife, Delia del Carril. She was pretty activated politically, and she influenced him a lot. And then, of course, the Spanish Civil War.
So what made him a communist with the capital C?
During the Spanish Civil War, he was traumatized by the death of Garcia Lorca. They became fast friends in Argentina. They hung out in Spain, and Garcia Lorca was murdered by the fascists, as was another poet friend of Neruda's. He had almost the opposite experience of the Spanish Civil War that Orwell had. Orwell was decommunized by the internecine fighting that he saw in his group Palm and the assassination attempts that he attributed to Stalinists. Neruda saw the Western powers balk on helping to send formal official troops to stop fascism. He would have realized this was part of what led to World War II, and he saw the Stalinists actually trying to stop the fascists, even if he didn't quite see it through the same lens as Orwell. So he said later that it was decided in Spain that when he got back to Chile after the Spanish Civil War, he would become a communist. And with a pretty big caveat that even though the Chilean Communist Party always considered itself Stalinist, it was always electoral. It was essentially, if not democratic socialism, then kind of democratic communism. They always sought to come to power through the ballot box. So this is what basically radicalized him.
And what was the Chilean government like at this point?
The Chilean government was vacillating, but one of his main enemies throughout this essay, the story that I tell, there were leftist tendencies that were established after the Depression in Chile, but when he's in Spain and then France, they're toggling to a more conservative position. One of the bureaucrats that he was dealing with was this fellow who became a president later, who I write about, Gabriel González Videla. And that becomes the sort of the enmity that starts with the Winnipeg incident. Now, he didn't come home to Chile until he worked the networks that he had at his disposal to actually help save some Spanish refugees. So another big turning point between his becoming a communist and the Spanish Civil War was after the war, he got reappointed to France to help move refugees from what he called pointedly concentration camps to get them to Chile. He found a boat called the Winnipeg. He was trying to basically make it politically palatable to bring this many people. This bureaucrat, González Videla, pushing back against Neruda's attempts to bring these Spanish refugees, this riffraff, as the conservative tendencies would have seen it, to Chile, was a big moment. It was almost, I think one biographer may have described it as nearing a constitutional crisis. He got the yes from the president. People in the cabinet were pushing back, and it was all stalled out, and he was going to do it anyway, and then he got sort of a tentative yes. But I think that formed, a tentative bond with this also potential enemy of his. They were adversaries, and then later when Neruda joined the Communist Party, they became, I don't know, frenemies or friends in a political sense to help each other get elected. So after the Winnipeg incident, Neruda comes home, or I think essentially starts as soon as the refugees land. And not long after that, Neruda joins the Communist Party and runs for the Senate. Now, he also helps Gabriel González Videla become elected as president on a very left ticket, a coalition of sort of radicals, communists, and progressives. And then very soon thereafter, the war is over, and González Videla, who's friends with Neruda, Neruda's now in the Senate as a communist, they're allies, I should say, more than friends. The Truman administration pays Chile a little visit. Admiral Leahy comes on a warship, and according to the syndicated columnist of the time, Drew Pearson, the message was pretty clear that they should not veer too far to the left. And so González Videla was the champion of a law called the Law of Permanent Defense of Democracy, which couldn't sound any more anti-communist or even McCarthyite. The leftists called it La Ley Maldita, the damnable law. It started the process all over again that he'd just seen in France of the refugees effectively being in concentration camps. They called these camps for leftists and labor leaders, they called them concentration camps in Chile as well. So that began this process whereby those two kind of frenemies become permanent enemies, and Neruda denounces him, and this sends him on the lam. His senatorial immunity was revoked. He invokes FDR to denounce these Truman-esque violations of freedom, and he's chased out of the country. And that's kind of where I think this book, the occasion for the piece that we're talking about in Poetry, Poetry Foundation website, is a new translation of perhaps Neruda's most leftist book, which has never been translated in full into English. And that book starts with him getting chased out of the country.
I want to get back to the run, but he was very impressed by the Soviets defeating the Nazis, right?
Yeah, that was, I think, another one of those moments where it was decided that he'd be that he would be a communist. From Spain to Stalingrad, he effectively saw the heroism of the Soviet war machine, the Red Army, and of Russian individuals and even civilians. And to him, Stalingrad was as holy a battle as you can imagine for a secular poet. He was following, you know, the news carefully, one can assume, reading the papers. Even the U.S., still allied with Russia during the war, was putting out Frank Capra-directed propaganda films about Stalingrad and how important it was. At Stalingrad, the Russians lost more than what the Americans or the British lost during the whole of World War II, 500,000 or so. They lost 11 million total soldiers during the war, as opposed to 300 or so thousand on the British side, and I think 500,000 on the American side or thereabouts. So to him, Stalingrad was just the event that stopped Nazi onslaught and stopped fascism.
And then back to the escape. The CIA wanted him. He escaped. What was the tale of that chase?
The chase starts with this battle in the Senate where Neruda denounces the president for the damn law, this law against leftists, which was effectively the Chilean government caving into the Truman Doctrine. And he goes on the run. The people who protect him are the same leftist network that he's just joined by joining the Communist Party. So there's a communist underground that's protecting him, and that overlaps with some of the Winnipeg refugees. So he's tried multiple times over the course of a year to get out of the country. He goes into hiding in early 1948. He doesn't actually get out of the country until 1949. So he's trying different routes by sea. They all fall through. And then ultimately, he takes a 500-mile drive to the south. There's daily equivalent of APBs out for him. It's a serious dragnet. I think they searched dozens and dozens of his friends' homes. Often the police would arrive just literally hours after he left. And he gets to the south where it's a little more sparsely populated. He's not as likely to be recognized as quickly. He effectively goes through a pass that he embarks from a ranch owned by a conservative southern Chilean who also loves his poetry. And there's this big debate about whether to tell the owner of the ranch that he's there. They decide to tell him. He decides he's going to help because he loves Neruda's work. And they go over this very dangerous pass. It's the rainy season. Everything else is washed out. So they go through what is called a smuggler's pass. And he's basically in this, you know, very dangerous trail of bandits and other kinds of people on the lam. And he finally makes it over the border after, again, multiple attempts. And they're sort of cutting the road as they pursue it. And he gets to Argentina, where he's hoping to fly to Europe, and his contacts aren't there. So he's up in the air for a couple of days. And then the way that he gets to Europe is he trades in his Chilean fake ID, which has him listed as an office worker. He's also used the disguise as an ornithologist for the rest of this trip. He trades that for another writer's passport, Miguel Ángel Asturias, who's the Guatemalan novelist who becomes another Nobel laureate. So he borrows the passport to get to Europe. He's literally arriving after news accounts in the Chilean press say that they're days or hours away from capturing him. So, big surprise, he lands on stage in Paris with Picasso, in a very Trump-like moment, the president, González Videla, says, well, it's obviously a fake Neruda. So the journalists who come to see him say, well, I wanted to see what your twin looked like, so it's nice to meet you. And it's kind of seen as this triumphant battle. I mean, in Neruda's terms, this is the fascist impulse of the... He probably conflated imperialism and fascism a bit more than other students of the Cold War or people living through the Cold War would have. So he sees this all as Chilean tentative movements towards fascism. And so this was another sort of triumph of anti-fascism when he lands on stage with Picasso for one of those World Peace Councils in April 1949.
I'm speaking with the writer, Joel Whitney.
And so how long did this pursuit and escape go on?
So it took him more than a year just to get out of Chile. And then he's effectively on the run in Europe, with the caveat that he's also sort of having fun, for about 3 years. And so the book that I write about, it's called Grapes in the Wind. It's kind of the follow-up to Canto General, his acclaimed masterpiece, both very sort of leftist, anti-imperialist, and even communist books. He's writing that the whole time. He's meeting translators in Russia. He's staying long periods in Prague. He's trying to find his way through France. He loves France. He loves Italy. But these are the Western European countries is where he's pursued the most by, you know, people who are aware that there's a warrant out for his arrest. Probably he's being not just followed by CIA people, which he was. He's also probably getting, the police are being tipped off towards these warrants. And so he's being detained in Italy. He's being detained in France. Finally, he gets a period of peace, which was made famous in a movie called Il Postino. He's got this little blissful period with his new paramour in near Capri in Italy. But all told, he's working on this book, Grapes in the Wind, and he's also dodging the police.
So when did he finally get back to Chile?
He gets back in the fall of 52, and he immediately sets forth to kind of recreate these World Peace Councils. So while he's traveling around for those 3 years or so, he's attending conferences. He and many of the attendees see themselves as part of the non-aligned movement. They see them literally as anti-nuclear, anti-war conferences. The West tended to see them as pro-Soviet. So he's going to those for 3 years. When he comes back to Chile, he wants to create this intellectual congress. And that's one of the first things he does when he gets back. And Stalin dies not long after he gets back. And he teases this book, Grapes in the Wind, for the first time at one of these congresses that he's done. And the Chilean government, of course, refuses to let the Russians come. So he's still having his political wishes compromised by the government, but he's been essentially pardoned, and González Videla has lost face through the incident.
It's remarkable, you know, from this perspective now, to think that the CIA would go to all this trouble for a poet.
That's something I definitely was interested in. I mean, I think the CIA and the FBI, when they were writing memos about him, they were convinced he was part of Common Form. They were convinced that he was much more formally a Soviet stooge than I think he was. I think he had more anti-imperialist tendencies. And I think the critique that you'll see in the piece is that he was naive, or to a fault, he was silent on Stalin's atrocities. And he was that way probably because he saw the Soviet Union as a counterweight to the U.S. imperialism that was much more familiar to him and so many Latin Americans. So he was a poet, but he was also a senator. He worked on, right before he was chased out, I point out, he worked on women's suffrage. He argued vehemently for it. He did so through kind of a Russian lens or a communist lens. So he was someone who, before the phrase soft power was used, he was someone whose different kinds of poetry, as it moved more towards politics, was helping popularize all these leftist tendencies that the U.S. was so afraid of. So it is ironic. I searched and searched for something that might have seemed like it could have a better claim to being the first global manhunt of the Cold War, but it seems like this was it. I mean, it took place in several continents, and some of it was just harassment and detaining him. I'm not sure how serious they were about arrest or stopping him. I know that Gonzalez Videla was, but outside of Chile, I'm not sure how much danger he was in. But it is ironic that it was a poet who spent so much bureaucratic time and American taxpayer dollars being followed and surveilled throughout the world.
But as you and others have written, the CIA took high culture very seriously in its early days.
Yeah, they developed a more nuanced approach to it after the 50s turned over into the period of the New Left. Later, Neruda got a better showing from the CIA, who would, just like others that I've written about before, who were as leftist as he was, got to appear with their non-political poems in CIA-funded magazines like Mundo Nuevo. That's not in this piece, but it's in my book. He was part of that post-thaw rapprochement. There was an exception made so that he could come to the 1966 Penn Festival. And the way that some of these cultural Cold War incidents kind of blew up in both sides' faces, I think maybe the Americans learned a little bit better from them. I think both sides learned that you can kind of do this Trojan horse where you give someone an honorarium for appearing in one of your magazines, and they're partly seen as on your side. You're kind of winning them over, more carrot than stick, I guess.
And then towards the end of his life, he did live to see his friend Allende elected president, but not for very long.
Yeah, I think the typical approach to when that coup started was, I think, the mid-60s. Sometimes the pre-coup years were talked about as track one in Chile, where the CIA was trying to overthrow Allende. But just as they did in Italy, they had meddling money betting against Allende as early as the early 60s. And one CIA historian called it a dollar per vote to make sure Allende didn't win in 64. Around that same time, this is also not in the piece, but it's hopefully going to be in a follow-up, the CIA was both publishing Neruda and also trying to undermine his chances to win the Nobel Prize. So in 63, they circulated a white paper trying to tie him quite falsely to the assassination of Trotsky. And they made sure to translate it into Swedish so he wouldn't be awarded that year. That was the year that Sartre won. But yeah, so they were working. Some scholars think that it's a good sign that the CIA was on both sides of a given dispute. I think they were just trying to throw money at the wall and see what would work. I don't think that's very promising. But yeah, in the case of Neruda, he was surveilled, he was followed, and because of what happened to his friend Allende with the infamous coup of 1973, Neruda's cancer kicks in, and suspiciously to some people, he dies just 2 weeks into the coup, and apparently his famous last words were, "They're killing them," meaning his friends are all being killed. So there's conspiracy theories that are trying to be proved, also known as hypotheses, that he was poisoned. I think they've dug him up two or three times now, and some of the family are for this and some of them are against it. I don't think they've found the poisons that they've expected. So as far as I'm concerned, he died of shock and cancer rather than poison.
And then finally, the collection you're writing about, The Grapes in the Wind, is new to American readers of Neruda, right?
Yeah, and it's pretty astonishing because he saw it as his most underappreciated book. I think he saw it as a follow-up to his masterpiece, Canto General. It's the same kind of grand Whitman-esque gesture to whole continents, whereas Canto General is his people's history from below in verse for Latin America, with gestures towards North America too, including denunciations of imperialism. Grapes in the Wind is kind of the old world. So he's moving around places that have just come out of World War II. He's writing elegies for individuals who've been persecuted, either so in some cases by communism, but mostly by imperialism. He's lionizing the soldiers at Stalingrad who fell, but he's also doing these amazing action poems where he describes in very much detail his escape over Smuggler's Pass, wading the rivers on horseback, and getting detained by police in Italy and Rome. So it's a very strange mix of these elegies to fallen heroes, kind of elegies for peace, and action poetry all in one gesture. And some of that he learned, I should say, when he was running for Senate. This is a very charming moment in Neruda's life. He didn't quite know how to make a stump speech, so he just recited love poems to the campesinos who would come to his rallies. And I think that element ended up forming his more sort of engaged social realist poetry. So even while we say social realist in the West, and it's supposed to be this really dreary kind of recitation of history's woes, which it sometimes was, it's also denunciatory, it's also ode-like, it's also very simple, very easy to read, you know, in honor of poor people, in honor of peace. It's very much deserving to be part of the Neruda canon in English, which it hasn't been before this past year when it came out for the first time.
That was Joel Whitney. His article in The Pursuit of Pablo Neruda is on the Poetry Foundation's website. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some of Peter Lieberson's setting of a Neruda sonnet, Ya Eres Mia, performed by Lorraine Hunt Lieberson with the Boston Symphony Orchestra, conducted by James Levine. Till next week, bye.